Introducing the Macallan Horizon, a collaboration between the Macallan and Bentley Motors. This limited edition release features a unique 180-degree twist vessel reflecting the horizontal trajectory of the automotive world. Representing a shared legacy and marking a milestone in two brands' pursuit of uncompromised excellence. Register your interest at themacallan.com. Please enjoy the Macallan responsibly. Don't drink and drive.
Hello, you're listening to Culture Call, a transatlantic conversation from the Financial Times.
I'm Griselda Murray Brown in London.
And I'm Lila Raptopoulos in New York.
Coming up on today's episode.
One of the major rewrites to the play happened 2 days before press night. I have a really good friend. He saw the play and he's like, everything in the play felt super honest until this one moment. He said that and like it kind of annoyed me and hurt my feelings. And then I was sat with it and I was like, oh, it hurts your feelings because you know he's right. And I went and I rewrote the entire section, sent it to the cast, and we put it on its feet that night.
Today's guest is the inimitable playwright, Jeremy O. Harris.
Yeah, Jeremy O. Harris is definitely the next big thing, or maybe even the now big thing.
The current big thing.
The current big thing would be better English. Jeremy wrote Slave Play, which you saw, Lila, and which had this amazing sold-out run on Broadway last year. It was a huge phenomenon. He had another play in New York called Daddy, which was set to open at the Almeida Theatre here in London soon after I spoke to him in March, but of course has been delayed along with everything else. But it's not just theatre that he does. He has written a film which should be coming out later this year called Zola. He's a co-producer on series 2 of Euphoria on TV. And he has also struck this amazing sounding 2-year deal with HBO, which we can talk about a bit later. But he's basically the person everyone wants to work with right now, I think.
Yeah, we're so excited to have him on the show.
Lila, how are you today?
I'm good, Grizz. Thank you. It's been a nice day, actually. How about you?
Well, Lila, today's been very exciting for me because today I ventured further from my house than I've been in about 9 weeks. I went to the hospital for a pregnancy checkup, just like a regular thing. Now that I'm in my kind of final third of pregnancy, these are like more regular appointments.
Right.
And I got an Uber to the hospital and just kind of looked at London through the windows. It was incredibly exciting. The baby was like kicking really hard. It was like the great escape. I was like, come on.
You guys got out, the two of you.
We broke out. So that felt good, like to see the world beyond your little patch.
Nice. And how's the baby?
The baby's fine. Yeah. No idea what's going on the outside world.
Oh, lucky baby.
But yeah, you and I have been speaking more often because of all these bonus episodes that we've been recording recently. But yeah, I would love to know what you've been up to.
It's so funny you say bonus episodes. My dad called me yesterday and he said, like, what's going on over there? You guys keep publishing episodes. Can you slow down? I was like, we have a lot to say. Anyway, so a couple things really that I wanted to recommend. One is I had the luxury of taking a week off recently, which I know not everybody can do. But it was a real joy. I mean, it gave me a chance to just kind of let my mind wander and get distracted by something in the kitchen and then like lean into it. So I made this Persian dish called kuku sabzi, which was incredible and very easy. So I'm going to link to that.
Wow. Yeah, I do.
In the show notes. But relatedly, what I started reading, which was very prescient to this time, was that best-selling book, How to Do Nothing by Jenny Odell.
Yes, I've been hearing about that book everywhere for the last few months.
Yeah, so it was published about a year ago, and the paperback is about to come out, so you all should order it from your local bookstore. And also, our listeners kept telling us that they've been reading it, too, so that got me interested. It's not a guidebook, even though it's called How to Do Nothing, and it's a little bit meandering, although that's kind of by design, and it's a little academic in its style, so you have to be into that, but it's basically about resisting the attention economy and how capitalism and technology work together to monetize every moment of our lives, which is something that we all kind of know. But she articulates it really brilliantly. Like, she talks about how our social platforms like Instagram and Facebook, et cetera, they depend on fear and anxiety and jealousy and dopamine manipulation, and how our value is determined by productivity and progress and the strength of our careers and building a personal brand. And all of that comes from this attention economy.
It's very depressing when you put it like that.
Yeah, and it feels even more like irrelevant right now. What matters is has all been mixed up and, I don't know, thrown out, and it's like less clear and more clear.
And yet at the same time, people are spending more time on social media than ever because we don't have as much to do.
Yeah. I mean, most of our social interactions have to happen online now. So we're almost more tempted by these forces. So it's kind of a weird time, right? So her overarching point is that we're people and we contain multitudes and we have a lot of complexity, and there's so much that gives us value and meaning that can't be packaged and promoted and sold, you know? So it was sort of thinking about how to resist. But right now, as you were saying, like, we have to have these experiences more online. We're more dependent on it. Also, being alone and being confined and being with ourselves isn't like a choice we're making, but a mandate. And so it was just like, it was an interesting read for right now. I really have been liking it. She says, which makes me feel better, that the villain isn't necessarily the internet or the idea of social media. It's not about like turning everything off. It's about the logic of commercial social media and its incentive structure. And so she asks whether we can use social media more as a public utility where you go to do something, connect, and then leave versus a place where you go and then scroll and then suddenly it's 2 hours later and you don't even know where your time went.
Yeah, so it's kind of just being conscious of how you use it.
Yeah, exactly. And I was interested in this idea of a public utility, and she uses public parks as an example of an act of resistance, like a place that isn't commercialized, but actually is a place where you can just go and be and use, and it's not going to be trying to sell you anything. It just exists for you. And I mean, I don't know about you, but as someone who's spending a lot of time in my public park in Brooklyn these days, Prospect Park, and I'm very grateful for it, like that really resonated. Like, and it made me think, like, what would the internet even look like as a public utility? Like, could you imagine? And it is, you know, I mean, like we all have to use it. So in many ways it is, even though we're paying for it. So basically, like, how can we use it that way was an interesting question that I have no answer to.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
We also had a lot of listeners suggest that we have Jenny O'Dell on the podcast, that we interview her. So I reached out, and in true, like, practice how you preach fashion, Jenny O'Dell is declining all interview requests until July. So she is not tempted to use this time to build her brand.
I admire her response hugely, and yet it's incredibly frustrating.
Exactly.
Just make an exception.
Right. We need you right now, Jenny. But the book does enough. The book does a lot. So the other thing I wanted to recommend that the world is watching, or at least America is watching, is The Last Dance, which is the 10-part series on ESPN about Michael Jordan's last season with the Chicago Bulls. Have you heard of it, Grizz?
No, I haven't seen it.
It was released early. So this is something they've been working on for years. And it was released early to give all the sports fans out there something to watch. And you probably know, Grizz, based on my recommendations, that I am by no means a sports nut. But I will say that there is something extremely moving about learning more about the greatest athlete of all time. And really, like, just the greatest anything of all time. It's pretty amazing. You know, again, I don't know what great basketball is supposed to look like, and I'm not going to pretend that I do, but watching old clips of Michael Jordan play is just like, it's like poetic. Like, it's beautiful. I don't know. He just looks like he was born for it. It's really incredible. And, like, you know, two former presidents are in it, and so it's just interesting. I mean, the documentary is really important to the culture and to this moment right now, and I really recommend it, and I will put a link in the show notes.
And so how do I watch it if I'm not in the States?
Yeah, so in the US, you can stream it on ESPN.com. And you guys outside of the US, in the UK and elsewhere, can all get it on Netflix.
Cool, thanks.
I'm definitely not going to watch that, but thanks for letting me know.
Well, Lila, you never know. I might surprise you.
Tell me about you. What have you been up to?
It's funny that you mention Netflix, because I've been thinking particularly about the kind of documentaries that you get on Netflix and developing a kind of, I was about to say a kind of thesis. I'm not sure. I think that's probably too grand a word for what I'm about to say.
You've got a theory.
Yes. So thinking about Netflix documentaries, the first one I watched, I think, this year was that Goop documentary or kind of series that Gwyneth Paltrow was the executive producer on.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that one?
Yeah, it was an advertorial kind of.
Yes, exactly. It was. I mean, it was extremely watchable. It was kind of weirdly fascinating. There was that one episode where all the Goop staff went and did like mushrooms in, I think, Mexico as some kind of like team bonding exercise like you've never seen before, which was quite interesting. But yeah, I mean, it was essentially a promo for Goop.
Mm-hmm.
So not really a documentary in the sense of being objective in any sense at all.
Right.
Then along came the Taylor Swift documentary, which I remember at the time you recommended on the podcast.
Yeah.
And I went away and watched it. And it was interesting in one sense, but also, and it wasn't made by her team or anything like that, so it wasn't the kind of Gwyneth Paltrow thing, but I also felt like the documentary makers were just very much on her side.
Yeah, they loved Taylor Swift.
They really did, but it felt quite unbalanced and kind of frustrating, and I was like, there's lots of really interesting stuff here, and they're kind of not quite digging into it. So that was a bit frustrating. I then watched a 12-part documentary on Netflix about babies. I think it was actually just called Babies.
Yes, you watch that?
Yes. The algorithm had somehow determined that I might be interested in this. Don't know how. Maybe it's all my Google history.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's basically about how babies develop over the first year of life. So like walking, talking, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And it was sort of supposed to be scientific, but basically it was quite a lot of glamorous locations around the world, loads of like drone shots, not many insights.
Right.
Considering I watched 12 hours of this, didn't really learn anything. And that kind of pushed me over the edge and it got me thinking, like, what is it about? I mean, obviously not all these documentaries are the same and they're not all made by the same people, but there are certain qualities that unite the documentaries that I've been watching on Netflix. Obviously, I'm just skimming the surface of what is actually available on Netflix, but they're kind of glossy. They're crucially international because they're trying to appeal to basically the whole world.
Yeah.
And they're often kind of lacking in rigor. You know, they're a bit meh.
Yeah, they're like light on substance and they're not really that trustworthy.
You often find out that they've been like made by the person they're about. It just feels like...
like a waste of time.
Yeah, like a kind of pretty waste of time. I'm wary of sounding like I love the BBC and no one else. I do think there's loads of really great stuff on Netflix and they have some great films there. You know, we spoke to Noah Baumbach on the podcast and Marriage Story was on Netflix. Netflix provides a lot of money to people who are really good and make good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And yet Netflix documentaries are poor. And yeah. Then Tiger King, of course, came along and I was like, right, okay, I am ready to hate this.
Right.
We don't need to talk about Tiger King because I don't think any more words should be spilt on it. I mean, it was like problematic in lots of ways.
Right.
If people want to know more about Tiger King, there was a really good episode of the podcast from the New York Times Still Processing all about it, which
yes,
they kind of
excellent.
Really pick it to bits and it's very satisfying to listen to.
It's a very good episode.
So this is the kind of like, I guess, anti-Netflix mood that I've been in since lockdown. And then.
Wait for it. Oh, I can't
and
wait.
And then. Along came Michelle Obama with her documentary Becoming, based on her memoir.
Michelle Obama solves all.
She does. It's completely charming. You can't, I was going to say you can't not like it. I think I can't not like it. I at lots of points just found myself like beaming at my laptop screen watching it. It just made me so happy. And in a way, It has all the things that I found annoying in other Netflix documentaries. Like, it's glossy, it's quite cheesy, it's made by the Obama's production company, Higher Ground. And yet, it's Michelle Obama. So
right.
It somehow has substance. Like, it's quite interesting about her relationship with Barack. It's very interesting about her upbringing. It has these scenes of her talking to community groups and particularly to young women, to young Black women. And it does give you an insight into her personality and into her kind of force of personality, I guess. So, yeah, I mean, it completely wiped away all the reservations I had about Netflix.
You know what we should do, Grizz, is we should collect what's actually good on Netflix. Culture Call listeners give each other really good recommendations.
Yeah, that would be great, because the thing is, there is actually really good stuff on Netflix. It's just sometimes hard to get to it. It's hard to find it beneath all the fluff. So let's get around the algorithm together and find this stuff.
Yes, please. So listeners, if you know of something that's like very good on Netflix or any of the other really available streaming platforms, write to us. You can tweet us at FT Culture Call. You can email us at culturecall@ft.com. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter. We'll put it all on the show notes. But yeah, let us know. We'll publish it.
Perfect.
Now, Jeremy O'Harris. So we really think Jeremy O'Harris is a brilliant mind. And the epitome of someone who's really pushing culture forward, which is something that we use as a filter on the show. You know, when we think about who we want to have on or what we want to recommend, we often think like, are they pushing culture forward? I saw Slave Play in New York in September and was really moved by it. And I actually recommended it on the show. So he was sort of on our radar from there.
Yeah. And at that point, I remember you recommending it. And I remember thinking, I want to see this. I want to see something by this guy. Mm-hmm. And then we saw that he had a play coming to London, Daddy, it's called, and immediately requested an interview with him, ultra keen, and he said yes.
So he ended up being, like, Ira Glass was the last person that I saw in the real world, my last day in the before time, before the world closed up. He was the last interview you did. He was the last person you saw.
That is a weird thing, isn't it? We both did an interview on the same day, and it was basically the last real day before all of this happened.
Yeah.
And I find it surreal to think about that, because not only was it Jeremy O'Harris, but we were sitting in, surrounded by costumes in the like costume department of the Almeida Theatre. But why don't you explain what Slave Play is about, because you've seen it?
So the premise of Slave Play is that three interracial couples, each has a white partner and a black partner, attend a multi-day retreat, and it's supposed to help them improve their relationships. And it's through this sort of fictionalized new treatment, and they call it antebellum sexual performance therapy. And so the first thing that the audience sees when you enter the theater is you're watching each couple role play sexual fantasies of an enslaved person and a slave master.
Wow.
Which is really very unique experience, especially if you're there with your mother, which I was. And then it puts all of those couples in a group therapy room with two sort of overeager researchers to talk out what they had just experienced. Mm. And so it's like extremely unsettling. It's often disturbing. It's often very funny. It's very poignant. And through the whole play, you're watching with a mirror to the audience. There's sort of a mirror facing the audience.
Oh, wow.
And the theater lights aren't fully off, so you can see yourself and your neighbors. And everyone sort of, I mean, it's a, the audience when I went was very diverse. And you can kind of be, you're aware of how different races are responding and who's laughing when and whether that's appropriate to laugh. I mean, there's so many things that are happening.
That's so interesting.
Right? So the lens is on you as well as on them. And what you understand and what you don't matters, and what you see and what you don't, and what all of it is sort of also on stage.
It does sound incredible, but it was very controversial as well, wasn't it? I feel like there was a big kind of furore around this play.
Yeah, there was. Probably because it deals with sort of a live wire. I mean, it deals with a lot of traumas that our country has inherited from our history with slavery. And for many that, and it deals with it head on. And for many that could be triggering. For some, it could be cathartic or eye-opening, like a combination of those. I mean, I left the playhouse with my heart pounding. I saw someone outside crying and sort of being hugged by someone. I saw somebody laughing. I saw somebody saying like, so what should we get for dinner? It just was it was an intense experience, and it affected people differently. They had actually like people trained to have conversations afterwards, like in the hallway. If you felt triggered by the experience. So, I mean, it was a lot. And the script is extremely direct. It just gets into it. You know, you're literally in a group therapy room with these couples. The white characters speak and interrupt and assume what their black partners think and take over all the space in the room and are very frustrating. And then the black characters also, over time, have a chance to speak and have space to speak. A lot is really said. And there was something about that that really kind of scratched an itch for me. It felt like a relief to watch these characters have it out very clearly and directly. I also recommend a review by Aisha Harris in the New York Times, which is called What It's Like to See Slave Play as a Black Person, if you want to read more. I mean, I'm speaking as a white person, so we'll put that in the show notes. What about his other play, Daddy?
So yeah, Daddy was the one that was kind of the occasion for the interview. It was about to open in London, as I said at the beginning. And it's also broadly about kind of race and sex and power, similar to Slave Play. He actually wrote it before Slave Play. It's different, though. It's about a love affair between this young African-American artist called Franklin and a kind of older, white, vaguely kind of European art collector called Andre. And there is quite a kind of heavy insinuation that for Andre, Franklin is like his latest acquisition, you know? So the play explores all of those kind of power dynamics, as well as being a really funny satire of the art world. Like, it's very enjoyable for that reason as well. It's using visual art as its focus, but I think it's really about Black culture broadly and the way that it gets commodified and kind of repackaged for white consumers and how that feels on the inside. I mean, it's quite autobiographical, and that's something that Jeremy and I spoke about in the interview.
Let's talk a little bit about why we wanted to have Jeremy on the show. I mean, how do you think that he's pushing culture forward?
So, I mean, I guess the first thing to say is that he is extremely talented. He's extremely successful. He's only 30. So, I mean, he was one of the youngest people ever to have a show on Broadway and one of very few Black playwrights.
Right.
But, I mean, I think it's more than that. I think what he's doing is kind of reimagining what live theatre can be for a new generation, for people who perhaps have been traditionally kind of shut out of theatre, like people of colour or working class
people.
And we spoke about, you know, exciting new ways of bringing theatre to people, especially now when we can't, you know, physically go to theatres.
Do we know what the plan is for Daddy and how we're able to watch Jeremy's work?
You know, I think everything is uncertain and we don't know. Mm-hmm. It hasn't been cancelled, so the hope is that we will be able to see it eventually. It just, you know, we just don't know when that will be, but watch this space.
Great. Let's listen to the interview.
Jeremy O'Harris, welcome to Culture Call.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. So both Daddy and Slave Play center around romantic relationships between interracial couples, specifically where one partner is Black and the other is white. Can you say something about what made you want to explore that dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was unconscious. I mean, I think that like whiteness is like a package or a container for a lot of different metaphors in the same way Blackness is. Mm. And I think that it's also just like the life that I live, right? Like I grew up a young Black kid who had to navigate a lot of white spaces in rural Virginia. And in a lot of ways, race is really amplified in rural Virginia because people are constantly talking about their difference based on race. So
is that different from New York, say?
It's only different in the sense that, like, I think the reason that a word like microaggression exists is because, like, in cities like London or New York or Los Angeles or Chicago, those explicit articulations of difference happen in, like, the micro, in, like, these, like, subtle ways that you may not catch until, like, you know, 5 years later and you, like, have some moment with your therapist. You're like, and then they said this, and that's what happened when they touched my hair, you know? Mm. It's like, and it's things that can feel more benign, but like still have a weight because of history.
Yeah. Yeah, so it seems like these plays are as much about like America's interracial relationship with itself.
Yes.
Like its history and how that history is kind of faced up to now.
Yeah. And I think that with Daddy specifically, one of the reasons why it's the play I've written that's been like most hungrily like sought after by international plays, like a theater company in Japan asked to do it. I think that there's something in this play about, I think because it's about art and commerce and like Black art. So it's like, I think this play feels, and also because like Andre's not exactly American, like Andre's, as the stage direction says, vaguely European. And I think that there's something inside of that metaphor that feels less about America and more about colonialism, too. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's one of the things that I think my plays have always been trying to figure out. It's like, what does the work that my body makes mean in a lineage of histories of violence and capture and, you know, and how do you feel free when all of the structures that present the work that you're doing are indebted to white supremacy and male power structures that like are outside of you, you know? That's why Daddy's in quotes.
So the name of the play is in quotes, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think also it's much easier to ignore white supremacy if you're white, right?
Yes.
I mean, that history, there's a difference between facing that as someone who's black and someone who's white, I think.
It's easy to ignore patriarchy when you're a male, like, you know, black, white, or otherwise. I grew up in a household with a single black female mother. My main caretaker outside of her was my grandmother, and I had a little sister. But there are still moments where I have, like, complete blind spots about how much privilege I have in the world in comparison to, like, a lot of the women in my life. Mm-hmm. And I'm, like, a black queen who, like, walks around in, like, skirts half the time. Like, the world isn't, like, opening its doors and saying, like, yes, like, we want you, necessarily. I mean, in a lot of ways it is, but it's not easy, right? Yeah. It's not as easy as... Yeah. People are surprised by my intellect in a way that they aren't surprised by a lot of my peers' intellect, you know, my white male peers. And I'm constantly made aware of that.
That's a really interesting dynamic, I think, when someone's surprised by you, because sometimes it's flattering, but it's also deeply hurtful at the same time, right? That sense that you surprise people because people aren't what you expect. They expect, sorry.
Yeah. And it's so often like shaped like a compliment, but when you really untangle it or look at it semantically, you're like, there was no compliment there.
You mentioned your upbringing briefly. Can you tell me a bit more about that? Describe the scene and what were your influences? What kind of things were you taking in at that point?
Yeah. I mean, I was really lucky because I grew up in a city that was an artistic desert, you know? I was in a city that was a factory town that was where the factories were closing up. Most of my family members, my grandparents, my mom, everyone worked in these different factories and different types of jobs. And then all those jobs started to disappear. And it was a really rough childhood. And it wasn't very even necessarily idyllic. I think some people who grew up like working class or working poor are like, well, I mean, at least it looked beautiful. It's like, no, I mean, like our town looked gross. It was a factory town. Mm. So I think I really escaped into books because books were where I could see beautiful things. And my mom was told when I was really young that like, because mom had me, she was 19. Mm. And someone told my mom, like, he has a curiosity that's special. That means he's smart. And you should not say no to anything he wants to do. Like, if he finds a book he wants to read, let him read it. He's like, do whatever you can to make sure you can feed that because you don't want to, like, hamper it. But I was put into private schools, and mom worked three jobs to make sure I could stay there. You know, I was really obsessed with, like, Harry Potter and, like, literally Merlin. And I'm not just saying that because I'm on some British podcast. Like, I was literally, like, I was, like, an adolescent Anglophile. Like, I read all the Chronicles of Narnia, all the Lord of the Rings and Hobbit series. And, like, in my mind, like, the only thing worth being was, like, a young British child who was traumatized. So, like, because I had trauma but wasn't British, I just, like, had this faux British accent. Mm. And, yeah, and I always wanted to be a lawyer. Like, that was what I thought I was going to do. Because, you know, in a lot of ways, growing up smart in a poor family, especially when you're black and queer, you either are going to become a pastor or you're going to become a doctor and a lawyer. It's like, it's kind of like growing up like an immigrant kid, you know?
It's like the professions are safer.
Yes, yes. And then when I was also 13, that was when I had this transformative moment of acting in My Fair Lady and being like, oh, I really like being in a theater. Mm. Like, I love this. Like, something changed for me. And I decided to dedicate all my time to theater all through high school. And my high school drama teacher told me, if you really want to take this seriously, if you really want to be a theater person, like, you need to read every great play. So she gave me this big anthology of plays, and I read the entire thing front to back.
Wow.
And that was, I think, where I learned more about theater than anywhere else, because I just, like, had access to every great play that was in the modern canon. And this was actually one of those rare books of great plays where they did have women in it. So, right. Like, Aphra Behn was in the book, Carol Churchill, Susan Laurie Parks. And, like, a lot of my favorite playwrights are these genre-defying women. Women who, like, take the canon and, like, fuck with it in a weird way. So it was really informative to be introduced to those at 16 and not, like, at 28, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm interested in the young black artist in Daddy, so the kind of the figure who calls Daddy, Daddy. I read somewhere that you had originally thought of yourself in that role. And I wondered, is he in any sense a stand-in for you? Like, were you exploring yourself through him?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's no way around it. I mean, something that was under the surface in my social groups, literally until after I did the first production of this play, is that, like, I didn't grow up with my father, and I've only met my actual father once. And that's something I never really told anyone. Whenever I talked about growing up, I would mention a dad, and the dad I mentioned was usually some composite of, like, the two different stepdads I had and the stepdad I have now. And, like, that obfuscation was in many ways protective, but also a way that I was hiding myself from myself, you know? And I think this play was the first time I really wrote myself down on paper, you know?
How did that feel?
It felt scary and freeing. And it also made the play something that I really wanted to protect and make and see done well. The play became more than an object. It became like a part of me. It was like a part of my soul and my spirit. And one of the major rewrites to the play happened 2 days before press night.
Wow.
Because I have a really good friend who's an actor I really respect. And he saw the play and he's like, Jeremy, the thing I love about all your writing is that you're always really honest. And everything in the play felt super honest until this one moment. And then there's something that just felt dishonest. And like, he said that and like, it kind of annoyed me and hurt my feelings. And then I was sat with it and I was like, oh, it hurts your feelings because you know he's right.
Mm.
And then I went to my cast and I told them the truth about my lineage, who my father was, how my understanding of a father came to be. And I started weeping uncontrollably. And I don't cry in front of people. And then I was like, I have to rewrite this play. Like, it's dishonest. So it's going to be really hard for everyone, but I have to fix this part. And I went into the front room of the Signature Theater and I rewrote the entire section that we had talked about. And then I sent it to the cast and we put it on its feet that night.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so the play that is being rehearsed now in London is that new version?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. And there's something that makes you sit up taller when you can say something has hurt you and you've moved through it.
Mm. Well, I was thinking also like Franklin and his relationship to the daddy character, to Andre, is kind of also a metaphor, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's about the black artist's like relationship to these white institutions, to the gallery system.
Thank you for understanding.
To money. Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, and can you say something about that? What were you trying to really dig into there?
I think I'm just still trying to figure out that entanglement. I mean, I think that, and again, spoiler alert, if you like don't want to hear this, stop. or fast forward like 30 seconds or something. I don't know. But I would say that, like, you know, one of the things that was, I think, confusing for some people in New York seeing this play after seeing Slave Play, like so closely after seeing Slave Play, is that Slave Play makes such a definitive articulation of the virality of whiteness. Like, there's literally a monologue that's like, it's a black woman talking to her white partner and telling him that he's a virus. And it's like this corrosive, poisonous, like, thing in her life. And the white characters in that play show through a lot of their actions that they kind of are, you know what I mean? And I think the thing that was different about this play that made people feel unresolved about it was the fact that, like, Andre's basically a good guy, you know what I mean? And I think that what I wanted to articulate with that is that even a space like the Almeida, I think in their like, deep commitment to doing this play, their commitment to supporting me and Donnie in every aspect of this production has shown that, like, they are good people. You know what I mean? Like, and the complicating factor about their goodness is that, like, I'm the first black male to ever have a play in their main stage.
Oh, wow.
From what I know. I mean, yeah, I might be wrong. And that's complicated, right? And every major producer of my plays has been a white person. I could either, like, reject the relationship I'm in with them or see, like, the kindnesses they're doing and recognize that inside of those kindnesses there are these tiny nicks of violence that, like, happen within it, which happens in every relationship, even with someone who's, like, the exact same race, gender, height, sex, everything as you. Those same nicks happen. Mm. But sometimes those nicks have more history to them than others.
Yeah, and there is something different about being a black playwright who's, like, exclusively produced so far by white producers, and interviewers like me and critics are often white.
Yes. One of the things I've been telling people in the rehearsal room to go watch is Satoshi Kon films. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know Satoshi Kon.
No, I don't.
He's an animator. He died at like 38. It's like and he was so amazing. He made a movie called Perfect Blue. A lot of his films are looking at like the psyches of artists, mm-hmm. and like how they break. And Black Swan was inspired by Perfect Blue. Darren Aronofsky got a lot from that. But I was like, this is a movie about the psychic break that happens when you are a black body inside of a white space. Mm. Like there is something that like no matter how excited or even fortified you are against there's going to be a moment of a break, which is a moment that many artists have in general. But I think that, like, I'm really excited about looking at the specificities of, like, the black psyche breaking and how we either put it back together or, like, keep it shattered.
There was one performance of Slave Play, I think, where you invited, I think it was almost exclusively black audience members.
There were two nights.
Two nights.
Yeah.
Can you tell me, like, how was that? Was it different? How was it different? What did it feel like?
I mean, it was, so in one way, it was different in the sense that, like, my director, Robert, was like, oh, this is insane. I'm not doing this again. This is too damn loud. It's too damn loud. But I think it was so loud because people were so excited. Mm. You know, there was so much excitement in the very first one that you know, for the first time ever, behaviors weren't policed in an audience. Mm. So it was like mainly young, mainly black, and people got to respond to a play like they might respond to a movie. And for me, as someone who actually like reads theater history, I did side-eye the microphone for some reason. I'm sorry. I'm just thinking about all the people online who have been very like, well, in the theater, this is how it goes. And I'm like, you don't know that just started in 1901, ostensibly, in like this country.
So do you mean in terms of like pitch blackness, everybody sitting in silence and not rustling? And
yes, that was an invention of Wagner.
Yeah.
Like he was literally like, you know what people are going to do when they see my plays, because I'm a fascist, is watch them in the pitch black. They're not going to talk in those balconies like they used to. Mm. And they're going to like sit here for 6 hours and chill. And people did it. And they were like, oh, this is cool. This is novel. This is new. Mm. I've never done this before. Mm. And then it kind of became a vibe. But before that, the vibe seems way cooler to me. Like it felt more alive and it felt like more like what we need for theater to move towards. You know what I mean? Like there's nothing where people can actually be like alive and rowdy together. And like one of my favorite conventions is that when people would do Shakespeare, if you do like a really great scene, you know, like an Edgar, I nothing am. Mm. And like the audience would be like, whoa, you killed it. Oh my God, we love it. We love it. We love it. Do it again. Do it again. And then the actor would just like stop and then like rewind the scene and like do it again. And I'm like, that's so cool. That was really fun about that night was that like, I saw especially the black actors in my play be affirmed in moments of the writing and in moments of their performances they never had affirmed, at least not on that level.
Mm-hmm. So like the black audience or the predominantly black audience would laugh at different times or like respond
absolutely.
In different ways?
It was so crazy. Mm-hmm. I mean, also like, you know, on the black night, what I saw was that there are certain jokes that like literally only a black audience got. And there are certain jokes that like the black audience was like, yeah, that's not a funny joke to me.
Yeah.
Like, I have this one joke that's a Sonic joke. It's a joke. I wrote it into the script thinking that me and my friends would laugh at it. And it's the character, Philip, is playing the violin and he plays Beethoven and then he starts playing a pop song. Mm-hmm. And the pop song he plays is Pony by Genuine. Mm-hmm. And generally that goes over the audience's head.
Yeah.
But then the Black Knight, everyone was like, jump on it, let's do it, ride it. And I was like, wait, you guys know what it is? Like, it's on the violin. It was so exhilarating that was the big laugh moment in that scene.
It's funny to hear all this and then also to know that one of the things that critics said about the play was Jeremy Harris has written a play for white people.
Yes.
I mean, did that feel like a surreal thing to hear?
It absolutely did, especially considering the fact that at Yale, the people that saved it were my black and brown friends. Mm-hmm. Like, the black and brown people at Yale School of Drama were the people that, like, most actively fought for this play and most actively affirmed it after multiple teachers turned their backs on it, like, tried to, like, shut it down. Like, it was not a good experience for me as a student. And the only people that made it feel like it was a worthwhile experience to go through were the black and brown kids in my class.
Mm. And what did they see that other people weren't seeing?
They felt affirmed. And they felt like they were freed by that play to do anything at school in a way that, like, was surprising to me, you know? Because I was basically being told that, like, I was going to become a pariah for doing this play.
Am I right in thinking that this time last year, you were still at Yale doing your MFA in playwriting?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've had so much success so young. And I just wonder how that feels. Like, do you feel overwhelmed at times?
Absolutely. I feel like the one, and this is going to sound so fucked up, but I think the one gift of the coronavirus is that I might get 3 weeks off. And I feel like in a lot of ways, I've been asking the world to slow down a little bit. And right now, everything's not just slowing down, it's like coming to a halt. I said no to a lot of things this year, and I said yes to a lot of things this year. And I think that, you know, a lot of things I said yes to were some really huge, big things that were setting up the scaffolding for me to have a life that hopefully won't be working poor, you know, for the rest of my life. And I think that the fact that I haven't had even a chance to process, like, my grandpa's death inside of that or the fact that I started out grad school ostensibly homeless and I'm leaving with the ability to have an apartment in Chinatown is a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
So yeah, there's a 2-year deal with HBO. There's Euphoria, which you're co-producing, is that right, for the second season?
Yes.
The film you're just referring to, Zola. So that's coming out like on general release this year?
Yes.
So, I mean, people will be seeing your work all over the place. Like, even if they don't go to the theater, they'll be seeing it everywhere. And that is a really complicated juggling act, I can imagine.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and again, it's all manageable overall. You know, again, one of the things I say to everyone is that my mom had 2 kids when she was my age, one of whom was 10, the other who was 6, and she was working 3 jobs that were, like, labor-intensive jobs. And the hardest thing that I have to do is, like, get in a piece of written material on time, you know? And that's psychically draining and deeply difficult in a different way. So it's not like I'm like, she actually had to work and I don't, you know, because I know that's not fair.
No, it's not as simple as that, but yeah.
But I do think that, like, I come from a stock of a family that works really hard and I don't have any qualms while working really hard. But I do think that when I'm asked blankly what's going on with me, I have to be honest and be like, I do feel overwhelmed because there is no, there's no stress. Like, you know, you don't learn how to deal with this in school. People I've met this year who've been really lovely to talk to are people like Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Or, you know, because she can, I can look at her and be like, hey, like, I think you're kind of the only other person I know who's had a harder year than me. Like, how did you navigate that, you know?
What did she say?
Take your time. Nothing will fall apart if you say no to something, which has been really helpful.
One of the things about having a huge success, which you did with Slave Play and with Fleabag, is like following that up.
Yeah.
Right? Like, what did you do next?
Yeah. She's just very cavalier and funny about it. Like, I think she's just sort of like, we're really good at this. Like, so don't doubt yourself. I think it's one of the things that she's been very good at telling me. Because I do have a lot of doubts about what I'm going to do next. And, like, I sometimes forget that, like, the first thing I did that everyone liked and the second thing I did that a lot of people liked was were things that I was doing when no one was watching, you know?
And do you feel like whatever you do will involve the theater? I mean, I was quite struck reading about this deal that you struck with HBO. I haven't really read that HBO before have specifically put, like, a pot of money aside for someone to be like, this is for theater work, you know, when it's like, well, they make TV. So do you just negotiate that with them and say, like, this is important to me?
Yeah. So I lived in LA for 6 years before I decided to apply to grad school. And in those 6 years, there was like a 2-year period where I was like, you know what? Fuck theater. I'm going to write for TV. I'm going to be the next Lena Dunham. And I love Lena and I love her work. And I tried to do that. And then I saw how callous and, like, how the ability to make art in that space was very difficult. It's very difficult to make art in Hollywood. Especially when you don't come from immense privilege, you know? If you come from immense privilege, you can be like, well, I don't want to say yes to that, and I'll just get this person to finance it instead, and I'll say no and work on this for 6 years because I can pay my bills doing that. And I was like, if I'm not going to make money making art, and I'm not going to be able to make art unless I compromise these things, like, I might as well just go to a place where I won't make money anyway, and that's the theater, and I'll just dedicate my life to theater. And in that moment, I decided I was going to dedicate my life to theater.
Because it's less compromised in that sense.
Yeah, it's less compromised. It's like, I can do a 3-act melodrama about my own personal daddy issues. And someone will produce it if it has that spark of theatrical magic that, like, certain theater people can see when they read it on the page. And that's special. And so when I decided to be a theater person, I was like, if I ever go back to TV, I'm not going to be a theater person who has abandoned theater, because I saw that happen so often. Like, people who basically wrote a play that was, like, ostensibly a pilot presentation. And they're like, thanks, theater, bye. And then they left. And then, like, you know, all these resources that were put into this play, all these people who actually wanted to dedicate their lives to theater who had to wait another year, saw that the soil kept being depleted. Mm-hmm. And I was like, is there some way that we can replenish the soil while making work in other mediums? And I was like, I think so. So I've been thinking up ways to do that for, like, 5 years.
And does that mean that the things that you make in the theater, like using this money, will then be shown on HBO as well? Or is it not necessarily?
Not necessarily at all. Yeah. No, because I want to produce a lot of things that aren't mine, you know? So, like, the lucky thing about it is that any plays I can enhance or produce with this money, they will have a direct line to me, who has a direct line to HBO, because I'm an employee of HBO for the next 2 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, coronavirus be damned.
Yeah.
But I also am not interested in asking playwrights to, like, turn their theater into movies. You know, like, Slave Play is something that people have tried to turn into a TV show, into a film, into all sorts of things since I first wrote it.
Right.
And I've been like, no, it's called Slave Play for a reason. Oh, what? Phoebe just texted me. I'm talking about you now on a podcast.
Tell her to come on the show.
Well, what advice do you have for me this year? The year of Corona. Okay. She hasn't given me advice yet, but if she does, I'll let you know.
Hopefully she'll respond before the end of the interview.
I know, that'll be really fun.
But it does seem like an interesting model, this idea that the film industry, which is so kind of booming, might support the theatre industry, particularly now in this moment of coronavirus, where actually things that are live and involve lots of people gathering in a space are, like, seriously under threat.
Yes.
And TV is probably going to do quite well because everyone's at home watching TV.
Yes.
And so the deal that you struck with HBO strikes me as also, like, weirdly prescient, you know?
Yeah. 2 years ago, I started developing a TV show with another company that was going to be this thing that everyone's calling for right now, which is, like, a lot of people have been like, we want a theater, we want to be able to stream theater, blah, blah, blah. And my biggest thing is that, like, no theater is shot well. It's, like, shot badly. It looks ugly. It's bad. So I worked with, like, an engineer and, like, one of my friends is an architect and, like, come up with the idea for how to do it right and make a thing that could exist inside of a streaming platform that might be able to present some of the most exciting theater in the world consistently. And because I have to finish a screenplay, I haven't sold it to a network yet. Mm-hmm. But it's one of the most exciting things to me. And I really hope that this gives people a chance to look into that, because my dream since I was a little kid has been that there would be some place I could just watch theater in the same way that people in a real theater watched it. Mm. Because there was no way that I could go see a play. The only place I saw through reading the New York Times or reading The Guardian or reading The Evening Standard. Like, I would scour, like, you know, so many theatrical chat boards to get a sense of what the experience of being at, like, Ivo Van Hove's, like, Streetcar Named Desire was, you know? And I think one of the things that I think people might wake up to is that, like, there is a necessity to create space for people to come see the theater when they can't be there physically.
Mm.
Phoebe just texted.
What does she say?
I heard the best advice for Corona, which I personally think you can apply for the rest of your life. Behave as though you do have coronavirus, not that you are scared to get it. Which I think is, like, the way to write, too.
Mm.
Behave like it might end tomorrow.
Behave like it's already happened kind
of
thing.
Yeah. Which I think is good. I think what that would mean for writing is that the fear that happens when you've had success is that, like, it might all end. Like, it might, someone might read and be like, they're a fraud. They can't write.
Mm.
So you might as well write like that's already been decided. You know, it's like
the worst has happened, kind of.
The worst has happened. Like, people caught you. You were always fake. You're an imposter.
Yeah.
You wore a mask and you got past the security guards. But now the jig is up. Like, it's over.
Yeah.
And I think that's how I have to start writing.
Is imposter syndrome real for you?
Very real. I'm very good at masking it. Because I went to a private prep school. Like, you know, so one of the things I had to do the entire time I was there was pretend like I'm I made sense there, you know? Mm-hmm. So I know how to, like, talk like those boys and, like, you know, stand straight like those boys and, like, you know, be like, no, I will not do this. And you go home, and for the 6 hours after you've said that, you're like, fuck, 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 they caught me. I'm fake. Mm. It's fake.
And was that, like, a very white environment?
Yes. Yeah. It was the whitest environment. It was, the only black kids that went there besides me were primarily basketball players. And right. And they hadn't let black people into the school really until the year they started a basketball team. So,
Wow.
Yeah. It was a school that was invented the same year that integration happened, so that rich white kids didn't have to go to school with black kids.
Right. And so, yeah, I mean, imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
You felt that from quite a young age, it sounds.
Yeah. Yes. And I had to learn how to navigate it and, like, bottle it up. And, like, there are moments when you beat one level of imposter. It's like a video game. Like, you know, on level one of imposter syndrome, you're like, I'm not supposed to be in English class for, like, honors English. And then you're like, I'm the best at this. And then, like, you go to, like, French class. And you're like, I'm not supposed to be in French class. Like, everyone else speaks French better than me. And then you, like, finally navigate and, like, see someone else fuck up in a way that you don't fuck up. And then you're like, and, like, you just keep going through different levels of imposter syndrome until you're finally able to, like, you know, be where you need to be. Like, at Paris Fashion Week, I, like, had thought, like, because I'd been to, like, a Gucci show, like, I didn't have imposter syndrome anymore. Yeah. And then I went to one fashion show where one person said one thing to me that made me feel so small. And I was like, yeah, Jeremy, you're a playwright. You're still, like, that ugly kid in high school. You're not supposed to be here. Like, what makes you think you're a fashion person? Mm-hmm. Like, what makes you think you're, like, a quote-unquote celebrity? Like, you're literally not. Like, go home, sit down, and, like, never go to fashion things again. You know what I mean? Like, and, like, I went back a level.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I want to ask you about fashion, but also something I've always wondered is, does success help imposter syndrome, or could it even make it worse?
I think it amplifies it. I think it amplifies it in certain spaces. Like, there's all these, like, really cool people who want to meet me and hang out with me now that, like, I've admired my entire life. And it's like, what do you do when you sit across from your idol and they're telling you that, like, you wrote something that they're obsessed with? It makes you feel crazy. You're like, that's not real. That's just not real. There are people I can text now that I'm like, that's not real. Like, I can't text Tony Kushner.
I mean, you just texted Phoebe Waller-Bridge just now.
But that's different because Phoebe was someone that was, like, different real to me. Phoebe, I met in, like, the realest way. And, like, she's really good at being normal. I think that's true of a lot of British celebrities. They're better at being normal than Americans are. You know, there seems to be no pretense about it. I think they also still feel like imposters a lot of the time. They're like, isn't it crazy we all snuck back here? And I'm like, that's the better way to be. Like, we've, like, committed some heist.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So you mentioned Paris Fashion Week, and you're sitting here looking very stylish. We're actually sitting in the costume wardrobe, which feels quite fitting. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit about style. You know, it's funny. People talk about substance and style as, like, two different things. And I wondered, do you think that's the wrong way of looking at the idea of style?
I think it's, like, the deeply wrong way of looking at it. I think that a lot of people are intimidated by stylish people because, like, for them it doesn't make sense. But, like, if you talk to anyone who's truly has a history with style and a deep understanding of that history, that history has been shaped by pulling from an eclectic series of influences that, like, far outweigh and outshape the syllabi that most people who've, like, situated themselves in one space of understanding have. So, like, you'll be talking to someone who is an editor of Vogue or something, and you're like, oh my God, where did that come from? I'm like, oh, you know, this is inspired by, like, you know, the 1766, like, da-da-da-da. And also I was thinking a lot about, you know, Petra von Kant, because, like, how could you not? It's like Fassbinder's moment. And then they go into this, and you're like, oh my God, like, I've heard five different things that, like, I have, like, a vague understanding of, and they're all in this one outfit. And that's exhilarating to me because that's how my brain works. Like,
that's kind of how your plays work. I was just thinking when you were saying that, they synthesize all these quite diverse influences. Like, there's pop culture in there, there's critical theory in there, which is pretty, like, heavy-going stuff some of the time. And they're all in this space together.
Exactly.
On the stage.
Yes. And I think that that's one of the, like, preeminent things about fashion that draws me to it, is that it's the best space for inspiration that I could possibly have as a maker, and the best model for how to make that I could possibly have at this young moment in my career. Because you know, unlike a lot of other mediums, like fashion has to be an art practice. That is an art practice that has to work on a like very formed schedule. Like every fall, there's this show. Every winter, there's this show. Every spring, there's this show. And that's an exciting thing to like ponder. Like if I had to do that for theater, how would I stay creative and honest at the same time? And there's something kind of interesting to me about just like the fact of making, even when it might be bad, that like gets me excited. And so, yeah, I love fashion.
Jeremy Harris, thank you so much for coming on Culture
Call. Thank you guys for having me. Thank you. This was really fun.
It was great. And out of the wardrobe.
Yes.
Wow, Grizz, that was so good. I found myself like stopping and rewinding certain parts so I could listen to them again because there was so much, which is kind of embarrassing. But I just really loved it. I mean, what was your experience of interviewing him? Like, how did you feel afterwards?
I think I came away feeling kind of invigorated. And in a way, I wished when he was speaking that I could also just pause and rewind and re-listen. But yeah, he was someone whose presence was just kind of magnetic. And so I just could have kept talking to him all day. You know, he had other things to do, but I was quite happy sitting there in the costume department just... just kind of picking his brains, really.
It's so nice when you interview someone that has that sort of power and authority and you realize that, like, actually, they are really that special.
Yes.
I liked that, what he said about it, that woman told his mother, like, this boy is special. Like, everything he has an inkling for, just let him do it. Just push him towards it. That was such a...
Yeah.
such a cool early memory to have. An important aspect, probably, to his success. I also was really struck by his and Phoebe Waller-Bridge's advice, like act as if you already have coronavirus and not like you're scared to get it, or act as if you're a fraud and we're already found out, not like you're scared of being found out and losing it. That's like an injection against imposter syndrome, sort of.
Yeah, which is so important when you find great success when you're still really young, I think, because imposter syndrome is a real thing. I mean, like he spoke about so well. And also that thing that he said that Phoebe Waller-Bridge said, which is like, you know, we're really good at this. Like, you've got it. I like that. Like, it's confidence that's really earned and deserved because, yes, both of them are really good at what they do. Like, they're doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's simple. Sometimes it's the simplest advice. The other thing that really struck me was when he was talking about the fact that all of the major producers of his plays have been white. And Jeremy said inside those kindnesses are tiny nicks of violence that happen within it. And that like that happens in every relationship, but have more history sometimes, especially when they're racial. And also that interviewers and critics are white, like your discussion about that. And he had this term, the psychic break of being black in a white space.
Yeah, I think often white people, we're not aware of being white. Like it's a privilege to not go around thinking about whiteness. You know, and I think you can apply that to gender and to other things as well. But I think what's really good is to think about being white and to think about what that means. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not just like a fly on the wall objectively observing the scene. I am a white interviewer in this historically white space of the theatre. And talking to a black playwright about race and about microaggressions and about these tiny nicks of violence, that really stuck with me.
You know, these things are hard to talk about, but that's important, right? Like, especially for white people, like us, it's good to be uncomfortable because being comfortable just allows yourself to be totally unaware and live with more prejudices and be more likely to, you know, incite more nicks of violence. Like if we have the privilege to not have to feel race every day, that should not excuse us from the conversation.
Completely.
Mm-hmm. It's better to make mistakes. It's better to learn. There's so much to learn. And it was nice to hear you both acknowledge that in the interview. That's it for this week.
As always, we love hearing from you. Tell us what you're reading and watching and listening to right now by filling in our short form at fd.com/culturecallout, and we'll put that link in our show notes.
The other option, which is our personal favorite, is recording a short voice note on your phone and emailing it to us at culturecall@ft.com. Please also remember to send us what you think is the best on streaming platforms, especially Netflix, so that Grizz and I and every other listener has something to actually watch in the coming months.
You can find us on Twitter at @ftculturecall or on Instagram at Griselda Marie Brown and at Lila Rapp.
We will both be back in 2 weeks' time.
We've been Lila Raptopoulos and Griselda Murray Brown.
Culture Call is produced by Lena Prestwood.
And our music is composed by Fatim.
Introducing the Macallan Horizon, a collaboration between the Macallan and Bentley Motors. This limited edition release features a unique 180-degree twist vessel reflecting the horizontal trajectory of the automotive world. Representing a shared legacy and marking a milestone in two brands' pursuit of uncompromised excellence. Register your interest at themacallan.com. Please enjoy the Macallan responsibly. Don't drink and drive.